Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove. I'm the Executive Director here, and I'm delighted to welcome you all to tonight's event with Samoan Prime Minister Tuilaepa. Let me recognise Dame Meg Taylor, Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum, as well as the High Commissioners from Australia and Samoa and Consuls General who have joined us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight the Prime Minister will speak about the new geostrategic landscape in the Pacific. This is a theme we're seized of here at the Institute. We've seen many news headlines this year, including one this week about the prospect of Chinese-funded ports in the Pacific and even the suggestion of a military base in Vanuatu. And these headlines have generated some strategic anxiety in Australia about the Pacific region. But one thing that has often been missing in this public debate in Australia is the perspective of Pacific Island states themselves. So for that reason, I'm very glad to host the Prime Minister of Samoa tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, the PM was educated at Maris Brothers School in Apia, at St Joseph's College, and before continuing his education at St Paul's College in Auckland. He earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from the University of Auckland. Before he entered politics, the PM served in government in the Department of the Treasury and as a trade expert in Brussels. He first entered Parliament in 1981. He served as Finance Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, and in 1998 became Prime Minister of Samoa. He is a dominant figure in his country, so much so that in 2011 he took the country from one side of the international dateline to the other. I know a lot of politicians who wish they had that much power, PM. He's produced important financial reforms, engaged deeply in regional diplomacy, and spoken out strongly on the issue of climate change. He's also had success outside of politics. In 2007, he was the first Prime Minister to represent his country at the South Pacific Games in target archery, which again is a useful skill in politics, I would think. He is Samoa's longest serving Prime Minister, having now served for two decades. We don't have that phenomenon here, Prime Minister. But he is in Australia tonight, not as Prime Minister of Samoa, but as Chair of the Pacific Islands Forum. Let me take the opportunity to thank the PM for hosting us in his beautiful country for the launch of the Lowy Institute Pacific Aid Map 3 weeks ago, when I was in Apia with Jonathan Pryke and Alexandra Dayant, and the High Commissioner and others were very useful in launching this amazing interactive product that really illustrates the aid that has gone into the Pacific since 2011. It was very generous indeed of the PM to launch it with the former Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop. The PM will come and speak. After he speaks, my colleague, Jono, Director of the Pacific Islands Program, will conduct the Q&A. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the Prime Minister of Samoa.
I was a photographer when I was a student, so I always want to take photos of people that I speak to in case I don't see you again. Mr. Chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, and the board, Executive Director Michael Fullilove, experts and operations staff, Jonathan Wright, Director of the Pacific Islands Program, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and greetings to you all. You know, when I look at you tonight in this very small room, I recall my very first trip to Sydney. I was accompanying my Minister of Finance at the time, and I was a very young official at the Ministry of the Treasury. That was 45 years ago, and I was 28 years old. We arrived the early hours of the evening, and my minister, who seemed to know Sydney better, asked me to accompany him to a certain street where there were lots of small restaurants for us to have our dinner. So we took a taxi, and as we came out of that street right at the end, a gentleman came out of the door of this big building and looked at us and addressed us and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please, all of you dirty-minded people, come inside and see my dirty show." And I found out later that the street was called King's Cross. That kind of first memory always remains in one's mind. And when I came here, the fresh memory 45 years ago came back to me. Before proceeding with my address, I would like to acknowledge the assistance which has been provided by the Australian Educational and Research Institutions to the Pacific Island countries, and especially to Samoa. Since the end of the Second World War, from the ANU Research School Pacific Studies, Professor Jim Davidson was recruited by the New Zealand government to be the constitutional advisor to the Samoan leaders at the time in drafting Samoa's constitution, which became the supreme law for the independent state of Samoa, the very first trust territory of the United Nations to become independent. Professor Davidson later wrote the outstanding book Samoa More Samoa, Samoa for Samoa, which remains the best account on Samoa's path to independence. It was Professor Davidson who started recruiting Pacific students to undertake PhD studies on ANU PhD scholarships in different disciplines. At a time when the Pacific is in need of research on many, many issues of vital importance to our Pacific Island countries, the Lowy Institute has filled in some of the Pacific research gap by placing a significant part of its focus on the Pacific region, Melanesia in particular. I must thank your organization for the invitation for me to provide a Pacific perspective on the new geostrategic landscape. The hundreds of islands in the Pacific may appear only as small dots on world maps, but they are situated in a large strategic area. For the Pacific, now is a time of profound change, and this change is occurring at an unprecedented pace. Geostrategic competition between major world powers has once again made our region a place of renewed interest and strategic importance. Climate change and disaster risk affects our people in a variety of ways, including increased severe weather events, scarcity of food and water, and displaced communities, information and communication technologies are burgeoning, and with them, issues relating to accessibility, cybersecurity, and cyber-enabled crime. While many countries are reshaping the global rules and institutions into ways that might not always support our interests or reflect our values as specific countries, we remain resolute to assert such. What immediately comes to mind is the New Zealand Labour government's anti-nuclear policy in the 80s. It became a part of national and cultural identity and was an assertion of sovereignty and self-determination, an assertion that was taken up across the Pacific Islands region and became a defining cause and concern for the South Pacific Forum, as the Pacific Islands Forum was then known. The Pacific region is again seeking to assert its common values and concerns under the flagship of our Blue Pacific Identity. We are building a collective voice amidst the geological din on the existential threat of climate change that looms for all of our Pacific family. The Blue Pacific Identity was endorsed by the leaders of the Pacific Nations Forum when we met in my country, Samoa, last year. It represents our recognition that as a region, we are large, connected, and strategically important. The Blue Pacific speaks to the collective potential of our shared stewardship of the Pacific Ocean. At this juncture, we would like to note Australia's long-standing membership of the forum and the endorsement of the Blue Pacific Identity, as reaffirmed at the forum leaders meeting in 2017. We are also appreciative of the inclusion of a Pacific chapter in Australia's white paper. As such, all Pacific leaders are prepared to assert their common shared interests in security, prosperity, regional stability, and constructive diplomacy, to be done in a way that elicits understanding and clarity of purpose. And we can do so without resorting to offensive and inflammatory language. There is polarization of the geopolitical environment. The concept of power and domination has engulfed the world, its tendrils extending to the most isolated atoll communities. The Pacific is swimming in a sea of so-called fit-for-purpose strategies stretched from the tip of Africa, encompassing the Indian Ocean, and morphing into the vast Blue Pacific Ocean continent that is our home and place. And what is being asked of the inhabitants and long-standing stewards of the largest ocean continent on the blue planet to ensure freedom of navigation and open skies for strategic access, the precious resources and assets that we have, offer immense value and potential to the major powers of the world. At the same time, these resources are the cause for panic, especially for countries that have been given to believe they are little and far too long classified have-nots. However, we are susceptible to being characterized as countries that have little, and that we should be grateful for whatever is offered to us. I see us increasingly empowered to reject this characterization. We are highly protective of our means of livelihoods, for example, embracing regional action to ensure the sustainability of our fisheries resources. And we are actively asserting our ambitions to ensure that there is inheritance for our future generations to come. But we are also beset with dilemmas as we seek to develop. Do we give up our sovereignty, our uniqueness, an upgraded port, for example, may bring greater connectivity and opportunities for growth in some ways. But could it represent a ceding of our sovereignty in other ways? There is a clear need to reinforce and support existing and promising approaches, particularly those that are non-partisan and non-interventionist. The reality is dark. We are again seeing invasion and interest in the form of strategic manipulation. The big powers are doggedly pursuing strategies to widen and extend their reach and inculcating a far-reaching sense of insecurity. The renewed vigor with which a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy is being advocated and pursued leaves us with much uncertainty. For the Pacific, there is a real risk of privileging Indo over the Pacific. There has been a reluctance to engage in open discussions on the issue and to share information to assist us in decision making. Our blue Pacific continent is becoming an increasingly contested space. The question for us is, how prepared are we to tackle the emerging associated challenges, regional and national stability has never been critical. Yes, and I repeat, regional and national stability has never been more critical in order to maintain peace and security, prosperity, and well-being of all Pacific peoples and of peace. At this very time, the region has become a more crowded and contested strategic space. I get the sense that our traditional forum partners have left the neighborhood, even if momentarily, and are coming back to claim a jurisdiction under their watch and to consider a re-energized Pacific strategy. Such an approach must be genuine and durable and premised on understanding on friendship, mutual benefit, and a collective ambition to achieve sustainable results. And in the process, our partners have fallen short of acknowledging the integrity of Pacific leadership and the responsibility they carry for every decision made in order to garner support for the sustainable development of their nations. Some might say that there is a patronizing nuance in believing that Pacific nations did not know what they were doing or were incapable of reaping the benefits of close relations with countries that are and will be in the region for some time to come. In cases where emerging partners have engaged with Pacific countries without conditionality, the relationships are perceived to be associated with corruption or unprecedented environmental degradation. One has the tendency to be bemused by the fact that the reaction is an attempt to hide what we see as strategic neglect. The framework for Pacific regionalism identifies security as one of the four objectives of Pacific regionalism. Security that ensures stable and safe human, environmental, and political conditions for all. While the Pacific region currently enjoys a period of relative stability, drivers of instability exist in the region and beyond. The 2017 State of Pacific Regionalism Report indicated that strategic global and regional geopolitics is creating an increasingly complex and crowded region that places the Pacific at the center of contemporary global geopolitics. This trend, coupled with broader challenges such as climate change and disaster risk, rising inequality, resource depletion, maritime boundary disputes, and advances in technology will continue to shape the Pacific regional security environment. Pacific Island Forum members have a proud history of working collectively in response to events and issues that have challenged regional security, peace, and stability. From the 1985 Rarotonga Treaty that created a nuclear-free zone in the South Pacific to a collective approach to addressing the existential threat of climate change. The Pacific region's current geopolitical and geostrategic context underlines the need for an integrated and comprehensive security architecture, incorporating an expanded concept of security. A stable and resilient security environment provides the platform for achieving the region's sustainable development aspirations. In recognition of this, in 2017, forum leaders agreed to build on the Pickett Tower Declaration and other forum security-related declarations as a foundation for strategic future regional responses, recognizing the importance of an expanded concept of security, inclusive of human security, humanitarian assistance, prioritizing environmental security, and regional cooperation in building resilience to disasters and climate change. Leaders have also prioritized action on climate change and disaster risk management, fisheries and oceans management, and conservation, all of which have significant security elements. Thus, Bigger Tower Plus is an outward-looking declaration that acknowledges the changing geostrategic regional environment and commits members to work closer together to promote collective sovereignty, including through the Blue Pacific Narrative, to strengthen information sharing and to control new and emerging security risks. At their 46th meeting in Port Moresby, forum leaders reiterated that climate change remains the single greatest threat to the livelihood, security, and well-being of the peoples of the Pacific. While climate change may be considered a slow onset threat by some in our region, its adverse impacts are already felt by our Pacific Islands peoples and communities. Greater ambition is necessary to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, and the Pacific Island countries continue to urge faster action by all countries. The Blue Pacific Narrative, which forum leaders endorsed in 2017, sees the region as a large oceanic continent, the Blue Continent. Pacific Island countries manage 20% of the world's ocean in their exclusive economic zones. However, the ability to effectively secure the Blue Continent is constrained by its significant size, as well as the very limited capacity and capability of countries' border management systems. Maritime threats in the region encompass a broad range of issues, from maritime boundary disputes, trafficking of drugs, wildlife and other contraband, human trafficking, and people smuggling, arms smuggling, illegal fishing, accidents, and disasters. As Pacific leaders, we strongly believe in being part of a Blue Pacific continent that is free from military competition, a Pacific that remains free from unrest and war that affect many other parts of the globe. We welcome those that are committed to have honest conversations with Pacific leaders on good governance and transparency, open media, inclusive participation, domestic stability, and developing resilience to enhance our economic prospects and self-reliance. The Pacific has undertaken significant adaptation and mitigation strategies in response to climate change. The existential threat confronting some of our low-lying atoll states are being faced right now. Investment in climate resilience projects such as improving food and water security, climate-proofing infrastructure, and land reclamation for urban development will help protect Pacific homelands and cultures and also reduce migration challenges in the years to come. Climate change is also increasing the frequency of destructive natural hazards such as cyclones in 2015, forum leaders endorsed the framework for resilient development in the Pacific, a global first for climate disaster and low carbon development. We would welcome support to enforce resilience and preparedness, particularly when we are experiencing disasters which can wipe 30% off a Pacific country's GDP. The recent disasters in the region have exposed the affected countries and communities to extreme economic, social, and environmental impacts. While there is some products available for Forum Island countries to cope with the aftermath of natural disasters, there is very limited support for countries to build better and to prepare to absorb the imminent threats from climate change and natural disasters. Global research shows that for every dollar spent on building resilience to catastrophic events, saves up to $7 in response and recovery. The Pacific Resilience Facility proposes to set up a regional fund to assist Forum Island countries, government, private sector, and communities to co-finance and leverage additional funding for resilience investment on new projects and or retrofitting existing infrastructure projects to make them risk resilient. The strategic objectives of the proposed Pacific Resilience Facility are to strengthen the collective cost-efficient and contextualized financial resilience by building strategic and genuine partnerships with key development partners and building national capacity development. It is important to note that the Pacific Resilience Facility addresses the current gaps in development financing and complements the existing initiatives in the region. We are indeed very appreciative of the Lowy Institute's tool on aid mapping the Pacific, which will contribute to informed decision making in the relevant areas of development cooperation in our respective countries. In my view, the Blue Pacific Platform offers all Pacific countries the adaptive capabilities to address a changing geostrategic landscape, the opportunity to realize the full benefits of the Blue Pacific rests in our ability to work and stand together as a political bloc. And the challenge for us is maintaining solidarity in the face of intense engagement of an event of an ever-growing number of partners in our region. We should not let that divide us. In this region, or in this regard, we are looking forward to Australia's stepped-up engagement with the Pacific, including through stronger partnerships for economic growth, for security, and stronger relationships between our people. I thank you for your attention. Choi Fua.
Well, thank you, Prime Minister, for such a broad-ranging and insightful presentation. I'll jump out to the floor in a moment, but I'll take the prerogative of asking you the first question. You ended talking about the Australia's government's commitment to stepping up our relationship, our engagement with the Pacific over the last few years. Julie Bishop also had a deep commitment to the region and worked hard to enhance the profile of the Pacific back here in Australia. Now, with leadership change, new ministers, and the notable noticeable absence of our Prime Minister in the upcoming Nauru Pacific Islands Forum, what impact does that have on our step up in the region, and what more do we need to be doing?
Well, You know, in every government or in any democracy in our region, there's always an ongoing structure. Government comes and goes, but the structure is there. Administration officials and advisors are there to advise new governments that come in of the need to observe the undertaking and commitment made by the previous governments. Fortunately, the change of government did not change the individuals at play. So we have that great confidence that Australia will continue to honour its responsibilities to the Pacific Island countries. If not, we will always be around to keep reminding. And we are always happy that the government of the day has always been very wise to send people of wisdom to represent your country as high commissioners in our part of the world. So we have one of the best high commissioners in Samoa, and we shall always communicate with her and to remind her of the commitments that have been made by Julie Bishop, etc., etc., etc.
So no pressure, Sarah. Keep it up. Folks, we have about 20 minutes for Q&A from the floor. Before the microphone comes to you, and I ask you to wait for the microphone, please do identify yourself and any affiliation, and make sure you do have a question, and try and keep it short. So I'm looking for a sea of hands. So first, sir, over to you.
Good evening, Prime Minister. Paul Hatfield's my name. China has been building infrastructure throughout the developing nations, including the Pacific, through debt. This has led to defaults and long leases of land to China. What is Samoa doing to ensure they don't lose autonomy to their lands to China?
For one thing, our lands, if I could recall, are on lease basis to investors that come in. They all face the usual terms as provided for under our acts. I do not really think that is a true perception of what is happening in the Pacific. There have been many wrong assumptions that have been published in the papers. And I speak for our own transactions with the government of China. Much of our loans are on soft terms, and we, of course, have a very careful policy on our debt service capacity, and we have a very strong debt payment capacity every year, where we first budget what goes out on our loans before we have anything to cater for our current expenditure, to ensure that the government is continuing with its normal responsibilities. And what is left over, we use therefore for development. And right up to now, we have a huge balance left over for our developments. So in far as Samoa is concerned, we keep track very carefully of our level of international debts. And of course, what we are doing today is a product of what we have been doing since we became independent. We never approached the money markets, the commercial loans. We always borrowed from soft windows of the Asian Development Bank and also the World Bank. And as you all know, Samoa was the founding, was the only member of the Pacific Island countries that was independent at the time that the ADB was established in 1966. And so we were a founding member of ADB. And we watched our debt level very carefully. The problems that developing countries face when it comes to debts with other countries is that they fail to have a proper system to ensure that the level of international debts is kept within what they are able to pay. And of course, in all our developing countries, you not only have to ensure that you have enough cash flow to keep the economy going, but at the same time, you should also have an adequate level of foreign reserve to back up your cash flow. Because whatever you spend on consumer, on consumption expenditure, is likely to flow over to your foreign reserve. And these are the issues that the government must always watch. It means that you must ensure that the best minds in terms of fiscal and monetary finance management should be retained in your Ministry of Finance and also in your central bank. When I was Minister of Finance in the first government of the HRPP, I recognized this prerequisite to good finance, financial management, and I initiated the moves to set up our central bank to keep a careful watch over the level of our foreign reserves usage. Thank you.
Talofalofa Prime Minister Lauingo, my name is Salima Dr. Olatangalo Vivadopinia from Sydney here. My question, I'm so delighted to have been invited tonight to such an important discussion. My question is on health, and I hope that you will be able to answer that. I've been educated in...
On what?
Health.
Health. Yeah.
I've been educated in Auckland, from Auckland, New Zealand, like yourself. We run a general practice here. Our question is, one for Samoa, one of the big issues is water and infrastructure in Samoa. And the other, so I was just answering if you could answer that question or else. And the other question is a very big problem we have both in the Pacific and worldwide, and that is diabetes. And the Pacific is one of the biggest problems as well. So, Prime Minister, I was just wondering if you maybe be able to help us to understand some of the things that are going on in the Pacific and how we that live and work in these developed countries of Australia are fighting this battle, because we have a lot of Samoan migrants from both New Zealand and Samoa who come with these health problems. Thank you.
Thank you. I was visited by the ambassador of Israel some several weeks ago, and I had asked him about the kind of assistance Israel could provide to our countries. And he told me a very funny story about New Zealand asking for assistance from Israel in relation to its water problem. So Israel sent some experts, and the report that came out was that there was no problem with water in New Zealand, in the sense that there was so much water. But the problem was there was no proper plan on its proper usage of water supply. That is our problem too. And so I asked the Israelite, ambassador for the same kind of assistance to help us with how to put in a system for the proper allocation of our water. You see, we have a lot of rivers and blessed with a lot of rainwater. And we have been diverting much of our overseas assistance to water supply for our people. I can tell you that all the assistance that we got from our association with the European Union, which tantamounted to about 6 million, were all invested in our water supply, everything, every single cent that came. And the second Lome Convention. This is an ACP EU association through the Lome Convention of over 20 EU countries and 79 African, Pacific, and also Caribbean countries, an association for help and also improvement of intra-ACP EU trade. So we diverted all our assistance from EU solely on water. The second five-year agreement that followed were also, the assistance we got were also diverted to water. So we have done quite a lot on water, but the, as you know, Israel is popular, very popular, with its irrigation policies and how they were able to turn the desert into agriculture. And they have this irrigation system some few feet about, below, with a small pipes carry the water in drips so that the sun at the top could not reach the bottom. And every now and again, a small drip of water comes out and water the large area of land. I was very interested in that, but I read up on how they achieved that. There was an old fellow who lived very close to the desert, and there was only one tree that grew close to his house. Everything else was dry. And he was wondering how this tree came to grow very well. So he decided one day to dig around. He dug and dug and dug and found out that the pipe that connects the water to his house was dripping, little drip, a little drip, a little drip. And that accounted for the growth of this tree. So he went and told about it in a joking manner to the scientists. They came and studied it. And out of that accident, Israel came to develop a vast, complex irrigation system. So not everything that came out of Israel was a result of scientific knowledge. It came out by accident. And so with water, we had always tried to ensure that we have provided water for our rural people. But in one area, to the west, it's always dry. And so we depend on bore on the, you know, you bore down and draw from the water that is captured underneath. The danger with that is that in many, many countries, the water is taken out and there is no counterbalance to the weight above. And invariably, the ground up top collapsed with subsequent disasters. So it can happen anywhere where we draw out too much water from the storage underground. In relation to the question you posed on health, it is a priority for all the countries of the Pacific. We had in 2006 experimented with a project proposal from one of a commission of inquiry we engaged many years ago, and that is to combine the management in general of the health services and to separate the special services provided by the healthcare people like the doctors, et cetera, et cetera. After 10 years of that experiment, all we found was more problems. And so we decided recently to bring back the two separate units together under one. We made that decision about 2 weeks ago. And in the process of discussion, we found that there were only three health services, hospitals in the world that follow that type of reform, putting together a general management side with specialized services. It's Great Britain, New Zealand, and Samoa. We copied from the New Zealand experience. Then we found out that New Zealand found the same problems that we experienced later. And they were quick to revert. And so we have reverted after 10 years of disaster. And in the discussions with people from the World Bank, whom we asked to come in to provide a necessary TA, we also found out that the present state of health services in Great Britain, because of this system, is the worst in the whole of Europe. So that we are doing something about it. We are now going to focus more on public health to try and control the same kind of disease which is prevalent in our part of the Pacific. And it all comes from eating these things that we import from overseas. We should have confined ourselves to our taros and our luau and our fish from the sea before these other freezer goods came. We were always very healthy. And then New Zealand sent us the mutton and their flaps. That caused us a lot of problems.
Hi, Prime Minister. Stephen Jedgetts here from ABC. Thank you for your speech. Just briefly, you've called climate change an existential challenge, and you've said you want greater ambition from all countries, including, I presume, Australia. At the moment in Australia, the domestic debate in Canberra is largely around whether we should stick with Paris. Some coalition MPs are actually calling on the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, to tear up the Paris Agreement. My question is, do you have a message to those MPs about climate change? And when you talk about an increased ambition, exactly what sort of increased ambition would you like to see specifically from Australia when it comes to cutting carbon emissions?
Sometimes politicians speak from their heart and not from their brains. We do not need to convince the people of the great damage that climate change has done to all of us, least of all Australia. You have too many fires, too many flooding at times when you are suddenly faced with downpours, heavy downpours. And I don't think you need to be told by scientists. Your own common sense will tell you that the world is different now. When I was sitting in a meeting of finance ministers, you see, I had spent 15 years as Minister of Finance in our country, and then I became Prime Minister. And when my Minister of Finance resigned, I decided to appoint myself as Minister of Finance again. Some 5 years ago, for 2 years, that was how I sat in this meeting in Peru. And up to that time, only ministers of the environment were talking about climate change, but no action was done because they don't handle the finance portfolios. And this time, all the ministers of finances from the whole world, and there were also heads of all the financial institutions, and they spoke with one mind. We need to save the world. We need to save planet Earth. And this is the only chance. And it is the finance ministries, the finance ministers, the financial institutions of the world that hold the key to what we need to do. You see, we all know the problem. We all know the causes. We all know the solutions. And all that is left would be some political courage, some political guts to get out, tell the people of your country, do this. This is a certainty of disaster. So when any leader in Australia, in Samoa, or in China, and the three countries that are responsible for all this disaster are China, India, and also the United States. And any leader of those countries who believes that there is no climate change, I think he ought to be taken to a mental confinement. He is utter stupid. And I say the same thing for any leader here who says that there is no climate change.
Thank you, Prime Minister. On that note, folks, we run a tight ship here at the Lowy Institute, and we have come to the end of our allotted time. The Prime Minister has a busy few days ahead of him, jetting off to Nauru for the Pacific Island Forum Leaders meeting. We wish you all the best for the meeting, and we hope to see you again soon here at the Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking the Prime Minister.